Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, can we visualize smells the same way we visualize colors?
And our Chef Talk series continues with Chef Bernie Kantak at his latest Old Town restaurant.
But first, the University of Arizona has a new president. The State Board of Regents has appointed Suresh Garamella to be the university's 23rd president. He'll replace Robert Robbins, who announced earlier this year that he'd be stepping down. Garamella will start sometime this fall. He's currently the president of the University of Vermont. With me to talk about this is Catherine Palmer, a reporter for Inside Higher Ed. And Catherine, first off, who is Suresh Garamella?
Yeah, Suresh Garamella is going to be the new president of the University of Arizona at some point this fall, though his start date isn't exactly determined yet. He comes to Tucson from Vermont, where he was president of the University of Vermont since 2019. And before that, he was VP of research at Purdue University. So he is a mechanical engineer by training. And he has been very invested in growing the research portfolio of the University of Vermont. He grew it up to over $250 million. Its research supports in the time that he was there. When he comes to the University of Arizona, though, he'll be at a university that has a much larger research portfolio. They're nearing $1 billion. And that was also a goal of President Robbins, who recently stepped down to grow the research portfolio there. So he'll be inheriting that.
How typical or atypical is it for, in this case, the Board of Regents of Arizona, or, you know, whichever entity is making the final decision, to basically be presented with a candidate for a job like this as opposed to a choice of candidates?
I would say that's not the norm. Most of the time, it's usually comes down to at least two or three finalists who do a big on-campus interview. But in this case, a faculty member who was quoted in the Arizona Daily Star, the newspaper down in Tucson, said that he really emerged as the leading candidate, that I believe the search committee was looking for someone with the research focus that Garamella has. And he's already the president of a land-grant institution, the University of Vermont. And from what I can tell from the faculty members who served on the search committee, they all endorsed him and thought that he was the best guy for the job. And here we are.
So you mentioned him building up sort of the research budgets at the University of Vermont. I'm curious what else stands out about his track record there.
Yeah, so he froze tuition for in-state students while he was at the University of Vermont. And then he also expanded a needs-based scholarship. So he's got a good track record on the access to higher education piece. He also got a little bit of flack from faculty members and some students back in 2020 when he oversaw some pretty major cuts to the liberal arts. They cut over a dozen majors and minors in the liberal arts. And I mean, that's a pretty classic story when it comes to higher education. People don't want to see the things that they care about cut. So, but aside from that, I say the biggest legacy that he leaves at the University of Vermont is growing its research portfolio. And that's clearly something that's been one of his priorities. And that's been a big priority for the University of Arizona for a long time.
Well, so coming to the University of Arizona, he'll, of course, be walking into a pretty significant financial problem that's been very well documented at the U of A. Is there anything to be learned, perhaps, from what he did in 2020 in terms of cutting programs? Is that something that maybe folks in Tucson should be looking for, do you think?
Well, I think it shows that, as a leader, you have to make tough decisions. We're in a really precarious time for higher education, and I think it shows that he was able to get through that and do things that weren't widely popular or supported, but still steer the ship. And so, coming into a place like the University of Arizona, which has been the subject of multiple controversies, he's coming into an environment where faculty members want to be heard. And it does seem that he has the support of faculty members right now, at least the people that were on the committee. And him being a faculty member so recently, he was even known to teach classes at the University of Vermont and like get in there and still work with students. So I think his willingness to work up and down the institution is going to serve him well here. A difference between him and President Robbins, who's just stepped down. Robbins didn't have that higher ed experience. He was the CEO of a hospital corporation and worked in hospitals his whole life. And so a lot of the faculty members said at the they criticized him for not having the insight of what it's like to be a faculty member. And so with Garamella, I think he has the potential to kind of win the hearts and minds of faculty members by saying, like, hey, I was one of you. I know what you're interested in. I know what's important, and I know what it takes to run this research enterprise that the University of Arizona has going on. And I think he's proven himself to be able to do that at the University of Vermont. And I think he'll carry that forward here. But of course, only time will tell.
Right. Well, so you've alluded to the fact that at least right now, faculty, at least some faculty, seem on board and maybe even excited by his hiring. I'm curious how important that can be, especially given, as we've talked about, he's walking into a situation where, some difficult decisions might have to be made to right the financial ship. How important is it to have buy-in from faculty and staff at the university when he might have to make some of those tough calls fairly early on?
Oh, well, I think from what we saw with President Robbins' tenure, it's pretty important. So I think it'll serve him well to make sure that he can foster those relationships with faculty. You're right, though. There may be some tough decisions down the road, and he's going to have to answer for it. But having those relationships built up on the front side may soften the blows if there are any.
All right, that is Catherine Palmer, a reporter for Inside Higher Ed. Catherine, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Arizona State Legislature passed a law last session that allows some people to build backyard casitas, technically termed auxiliary dwelling units. And it didn't take long for stories of neighborhood battles to begin. Homeowners devastated that their neighbors are building ADUs overlooking their yards, concerned about their property values. It's all too close for comfort, as one Valley mom told Arizona's family. It's a real pain point in communities for some neighbors, but housing advocates and the lawmakers who passed the new regulations did it to ease our state's ongoing affordable housing crisis. But why does this really seem to touch a nerve for people? I took that question to a big advocate for backyard casitas, Richard Kallenberg. He's director of housing policy for the Progressive Policy Institute.
Well, people's homes are extremely important to them, and they see it as a place of refuge, a place to go relax. And so they care a lot about the environment around them. And the other factor here is people are naturally averse to change, worried about what will happen if something in their environment changes. And so we see massive amounts of resistance to even modest reforms in housing.
Yeah. And those have happened all over the country. But you also, in your work, have traced them back to exclusionary and sometimes racist policies, right, in terms of restrictive zoning.
Yes. So if you look back at the history of zoning in America, it starts out with a benign effort to separate industrial uses from residential uses, and that makes sense for people's health and safety. But quickly, it morphed into something much darker. And in many cities in the early 20th century, municipalities adopted racial zoning laws. And under those laws, Black people were not allowed by law to move into predominantly white neighborhoods. And the same arguments that are sometimes used today to preserve zoning laws were used back then, including property values. The mayor of Baltimore said the reason we need to quarantine Black people to keep them separate from white people was to protect the property values of white homeowners.
Hmm. So, I mean, there's also an irony here, right? Because we see what would often be called NIMBYism, right? In not just, you know, conservative places, but often in, as you point out in your work, like some of the most liberal cities in America.
Yes. And as a liberal myself, this was a disconcerting finding. But in fact, the research is very, very clear that the worst forms of exclusionary zoning are more prevalent in politically liberal areas. Hmm. And the benign explanation for that is that liberals care about democracy, they care about the environment. And so, some of these regulations were put in place to make sure that people had a say in how their community was going to change, efforts to protect the environment. But those have really been weaponized in recent years by highly educated people, many of whom are liberal, to exclude others who are of lesser means. And so I think that liberals have to, we have to look ourselves in the mirror on that question and say, is there something really troubling going on with exclusionary zoning?
So that's really interesting because I'm sure, I mean, I understand the academic kind of reasoning there, but I'm sure you've heard this from folks, right? Like lots of the people who are mad about, their neighbor building a large casita overlooking their backyard would say, I'm not racist and I'm not classist. I just think this is an intrusion, right? Like there's got to be something more on the human level that also seems to happen here.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think there are reasonable restrictions on what can be built in a particular community, and that those restrictions tend to go to, issues of scale. How large are the units, and are these new units tastefully created, or are they eyesores? Those kind of things are all legitimate to discuss and to debate, but too often the aesthetic argument, the argument about neighborhood character, is used as an excuse to exclude as well.
Hmm. I wonder, as we're watching these debates play out across the city of Phoenix, I mean, is this just a sticking point in a city's development? Like in a generation, will this be normal? Have we seen this and the result of it on the other side in other places?
Yes. I mean, I think the current path is unsustainable. Housing has become unaffordable for young people. They're delaying marriage, delaying family. They are, people who are, by all measures, playing by the rules, doing everything that society asks them to, mm-hmm. Are still struggling. And that's at the middle and upper ends of the socioeconomic spectrum. And then because there is not enough housing, we have a terrible challenge with homelessness, and mm-hmm. And that's not something that anyone in a society should want. So people have to live somewhere, and when we restrict the supply of housing artificially, then it drives up the price of housing, and everyone suffers. So I think over the long haul, we will see a culture shift. And ironically, it's not kind of some brave new future. It's really a return to what American society used to be like. There used to be a great heterogeneity in building types, and you had lots of row houses and duplexes and triplexes near single family homes. And so allowing that diversity of types of home will allow greater economic and racial diversity in a community. And I think at the end, everyone will be better off. Mm-hmm. As I said, change is hard. And in Minneapolis, which is one of the communities that kind of has been on the cutting edge of making reform, there was a lot of resistance initially to, backyard units, accessory dwelling units. And, one of the arguments made by a city council member was, well, these are going to be houses of prostitution. Well, that didn't turn out to be true. And so, as change came, Minneapolis was willing to make even greater change. And so they've now eliminated the idea of exclusionary single family zoning throughout the city. And so you can build a duplex or a triplex anywhere in Minneapolis.
That's really interesting. What about, though, when they're used as short-term rentals? Does that do the same thing to alleviate the housing crisis?
Well, I think there are different uses that have different implications. Again, coming back to the basic notion that people have to live somewhere, the use of a short-term rental has a different meaning than, providing someone a more permanent home. But it is a place where people who are looking for a short-term rental will have that possibility, and that frees up a different unit somewhere else. Yeah. So the bigger point is, when you increase supply, you will end up with more moderate price increases, and that's good for our society.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Richard Kahlenberg, Director of Housing Policy for the Progressive Policy Institute, author of the book Excluded, How Snob Zoning, NIMBYism, and Class Bias Build the Walls We Don't See. Richard, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time to talk about this.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, is it possible to teach a computer how to smell?
Molecules that smell similar to each other are in similar places on the map, and molecules that smell very different from each other are in different places. And then you can look at the map and you can say, oh, that's where all the peach smells lie, and oh, that's where all the jasmine smells are.
We'll find out exactly what a principal odor map is.
But first, I'm joined in studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. So you guys, I recently took a tour of the ancestral homeland of the Yaqui people. I took a walk along the banks of the Yaqui River in the rain. I learned about the plants that play a central role in the Yaqui community's origin story. And I listened to an oral history of how the Yaqui came to make their home in Sonora.
Sounds like a pretty rich experience.
It was. But the thing is, I did all of this without leaving my desk.
Huh.
It was part of a digital architecture project by Selena Martinez, an architect here in the Valley who focuses on using principles of design to add cultural context to built environments in both the physical and digital realms. And as she told me recently, this all started when she used to watch her dad work on their family's house as a kid.
And I just always remember that whenever it would come to, like, the flooring, it would be, like, tile specifically. He would integrate, like, special designs and things like that that would always come out, like, so perfect. And I always found that to be just something special beyond just, like, laying tile.
That's interesting. So if I'm hearing you right, it's almost like you had this kind of early realization that you can put some of yourself into your living space.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm Yaqui and Chicana, so on my mother's side, she's the Yaqui one. And we would constantly visit Benghamo in Scottsdale. That's a Yaqui village over there. And that's actually where my grandfather is still alive. But most of my family also lives in Guadalupe, another Yaqui community. So, yeah, going between growing up in Phoenix to Benghamo and even to Guadalupe for our cultural ceremonies are kind of like the three main environments I remember interacting with as I grew up.
What do you remember noticing as different between your life in Phoenix versus your life in the Yaqui communities?
Yeah. So specifically where my mom grew up in Benghamo, there's like this mural actually in one of the alleyways that was done. And it's kind of like a nod to our culture and like where we come from, since our tribe is actually from Sonora along the Rio Yaqui. So I think those kind of things help create, I guess, those context clues, you know, that otherwise maybe other residents in that area wouldn't know about.
And what kinds of examples of that were you drawn towards? If you think about the initial designs that you came up with yourself, what were some ways that you wanted to reflect the cultural history of the world in the built elements of that world?
Mm-hmm. It wasn't really till grad school that I got the opportunity to explore that through an independent project. And I chose to focus it on integrating culture into the built environment, specifically my own culture. I had an interest like in plants because that's all contextualized to a specific place. So that was the type of things I was exploring, all the layers, history, and then the kind of like digital archive of actual places in our community.
Speaking of your digital work, I was really fascinated by your Species of the River project. Tell me how that came about, because that strikes me as a way of using digital modeling to explore Yaqui culture in an even deeper way without necessarily needing to set foot there if that's not feasible for you.
Yeah. So the British Museum, they actually found me on Instagram and slid into my DMs.
Okay.
And asked me for a coffee, and I decided to meet up with them. They mentioned that they were really interested in my work because of the 3D aspect to it. And specifically, I use 3D laser scanning to document these places, which give it a very much realistic feel when you're looking and interacting with the model online. And it's basically a form of cultural preservation is how I see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the result of all this is this digital exhibition that combines so many of the elements we've been talking about. And I thought, just for a minute here, if it's okay with you, we could maybe step into the exhibition and you could tell us a little bit about some of the choices that you made with it. So if I could ask you to put your headphones on.
Sure.
I will bring it up here. So we get to the landing page and it says Species of the River, and there's a button that says enter. So I'm going to enter. And we see some text that says, lead the way. So instantly what happens is we're dropped into this rendered environment. I know you can't see the image right now, but tell me about what I'm looking at. I imagine you remember it.
So right when you enter this space, you can automatically hear that it's raining. And as you scroll forward into the 3D environment, you will begin to see these orbs. And those are basically portals to more information.
Okay, so right now I'm using the mouse. I'm moving it to the left and the right, and I'm looking around, and I see the river. It looks like it's maybe early in the morning. The sun is just coming up, and there's plants by the side of the riverbed. And then I'm scrolling with the mouse, and I do see one of the orbs. And inside of it, there's a green plant, so I'm going to highlight this orb.
Oh, yeah, cool. And then you can click into it, and you can click onto it again, and then that enters into flat pages with more text, written information. There's more visuals. We have contributors, local photographer Alexis Lopez, who contributed a variety of analog work representing photos from our Rio Yaqui trips, as well as a contributor, Alex Figueroa, who did a lot of the illustrations.
And so now what I'm looking at is an image of a tree, and there's also a button where I can listen to you tell us a story about what we're looking at. So I'm gonna bring that up if you wouldn't find it too strange.
In ancient times, when our ancestors, the Surem, inhabited this land, a mesquite tree started to creak loudly. No one understood the ancient language of the tree. A woman was found to interpret the message.
This is the story of our, well, this is one version of the story, I should say, of our emergence story and how we as Yaqui people came into this world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's really a remarkable experience to move through this digital landscape that you have created, because the 3D rendering feels very futuristic. You know, and it's sort of abstract visually, but you have these very natural sounds in the background that aren't abstracted at all. And then obviously there's that sound that we hear when we highlight the orb. Let me see if I can do that again.
Yeah.
which does have sort of a almost a video game sort of feel to it. And the effect is that I feel like I'm in the world in several ways at the same time. I feel very present on a website, which is not an experience I've had before. So tell me more about how this project informs the similar work you would like to do in the future.
For me, it's like almost a storyboard for what could come next, what other experience could be created, whether it's just online or even through VR headsets or other immersive experience types where you can really feel like you're even more deeply in it. You can go into other areas maybe in the homelands or other communities. I spend most of my days just on the computer digitally because that's my profession, but I think that it's something that we're not going to escape anytime soon, so why not lean into that? That's another way that I feel as an architect I can contribute, because I really love like culture preservation. I can even see other tribes teaching in this way. There's language involved, you know. It just becomes more experiential.
All right. Well, Selena Martinez is an architect here in Phoenix. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And now it's time to meet the next chef in our series, Chef Talk. Here I sit down with a chef each month from fine dining rooms to nightclub kitchens and find out what makes them tick. And today I sit down with longtime Arizona chef Bernie Kantek. You might know his name from Peter Kapersky's Cowboy Chow, Citizen Public House, or The Gladly. His new concept is Beginner's Luck, a brunch, lunch, and dinner spot in an almost hidden historic building in the heart of Old Town Scottsdale. Kantek has spent his entire culinary career here in the Valley, but he isn't from here, and he didn't start out in the food world. He was an art student from upstate New York. His grandfather was a butcher who owned a meat market right next to his brother's restaurant. And on the other side of the family, his grandmother ran a reception hall in Ohio at a Hungarian church. And that is where our conversation began.
They made all Hungarian food, chicken paprikash, lots of stuffed cabbage. I would spend summers with her, or whenever I was there, they would, you know, have bingo nights like most churches. If I smell Fritos, like it literally transports me there. It's crazy. They always had little bags of chips, and I would always have Fritos and Pepsi.
I understand, though, you didn't like want to go into restaurants. This was not like the direction you thought you would go.
I didn't. I started working in restaurants when I was 14. I washed dishes, bus tables, prep cook, line cook, served a little bit, bartended a little bit. I've done pretty much everything you can do. The places I worked, people always seemed miserable, to be perfectly honest. And I didn't want that for myself. Like, who would? So I went to college and was kind of lost, didn't really know what I wanted to do. My advisor, my freshman year, the super hippie dude, Alan Mooney, he was like, dude, you should take like an easy class. You're taking all these crazy classes. Take something easy. You're going to have to take some kind of art class or something. Mm-hmm. And he was actually the sculpture professor. Talked me into taking like a ceramics class. He was always talking about food. Always had wine. Literally, I would go into his office and he was drinking wine. So, and we would always talk about food throughout my time at Cortland. That's where I went, SUNY Cortland. He asked if I ever thought about expressing myself in a kitchen instead of a studio. I don't really know what that says about like my art ability. but he knew it was something that I was, you know, passionate about food, and I like that it connects with people like art does. But I'm not one of those people that think that food is an art. I think they're two separate things.
That's interesting. I was going to ask that because you came from the art world. Okay. So you go to culinary school. You do, in fact, become a chef. And you've worked in the Valley for a really long time, kind of worked your way up, became really well known, what, 2 decades ago maybe, for Citizen Public House, The Gladly, like some of these big name restaurants that we all know. We're sitting in your newest restaurant now, Beginner's Luck, we should say. Talk a little bit about working your way up through the scene here after graduating culinary school in Scottsdale. Like, why did you stay?
I had every intention of moving back to New York. I have one sister in Brooklyn. One was in Manhattan at the time. That's where you go to cook. There, Chicago, San Francisco, or go abroad. I was super broke. I needed to make a little bit of money. So I was like, all right, I'm going to work for a year and then I'll move back to New York. I interviewed at Cowboy Chow. Peter, who did not want to hire me, but luckily his partners, Tanya and Marianne, really liked me. They brought me on just for a stage for a little while. And Marianne was in the kitchen at the time. And she's like, I hate the kitchen. I don't know what I'm doing. Take it. I'm going out front. I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing either. So lots of learning as I went. Peter was amazing to work for. He instilled a lot of the philosophies that we carry on. Like, he was always about, you know, knowing your neighbor and making people happy and doing whatever it takes to really make everybody feel at home. And it's super important. That's what it's about.
So you got into Cowboy Chow and just never left this part of the world.
I was there for 12 years. Opened up Cashmere's, which was open. God, I think Casbar's still open. Saw lots and lots of changes here. You know, when I first started at Chow, there was really nothing in downtown Scottsdale except for bars. But yeah, I've seen it go from all really tiny buildings into all these kind of high rises.
I wonder what you make of that, of the changes in Old Town for one thing, but also just in the Valley in general, like having stayed here and become one of the best known chefs in this part of the country. Like, do you think that we are on the map in a way that we deserve now? Or is this still not, you know, New York, Chicago, LA, San Francisco, like you meant to go back to initially?
I don't think we get the credit for what we do. I think some of it is due to the weird spread out nature of like Phoenix, Mesa, Scottsdale. I think that's probably our biggest issue here, because the talent's definitely here. We're still kind of in our, I wouldn't say infancy, like we're probably in our early 20s.
I thought you were going to say teen years, but fair enough.
You know, Chicago, New York, San Francisco have been around for a while.
So let me ask you a little bit about the restaurant we're at now and the inspiration here. You're kind of known for comfort food of a certain kind, right? Like maybe something that's a little bit unique on comfort food, a twist on it, something that's upscale, kind of like that. Tell us about the inspiration here and sort of what it's like to be able to have the freedom as a chef after so many years to be able to open a new place and say, I want it like this, you know?
Hey, I like to think of the food here as being even more kind of inviting. You know, you have those friends that give you like those huge bear hugs where you just don't kind of want to let go. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to do with food here. Like there's a bowl of cereal with blue corn mush and chia pudding with granola and blue corn flour berries. And I never thought in a million years that I'd be pushing cereal on.
Right.
But it's like my favorite thing. Whenever I see a new face, I'll make a tiny little bowl for him and bring it over.
Okay, so a couple of quick questions at the end here that I always ask every chef in this series. What is your favorite dish on this menu in this restaurant here where we're sitting, Beginner's Luck? And talk a little bit about like the reason why, like the process of making it. Give us the nitty gritty on what this dish is. Can you choose a favorite?
I don't think I can. We have a sausage and aligo at night with eggplant. Aligo is like a potato fondue. I don't know. I find myself saying, oh, that's my favorite. Like every time I have something in front of me, whether it's the burrata with pili foil and Chinese almonds, I can't pick a favorite.
Choosing a favorite child. Fair enough. Okay. Final question then. What is it that is in your refrigerator at home? Do you cook for yourself at home? Most chefs do not.
I do. I actually made, I'm all about noodles and soup. And I made a beef shank stew yesterday with noodles and lots of kimchi.
That sounds amazing. So you're cooking at home, even though you cook all day at work?
Yes.
That's the sign of true love right there. All right. Chef, thank you so much for having me out. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Many of us have used color wheels to get a visual sense of which colors are similar to each other and which are not. But there's not really been a way to see which smells are similar to each other until now. Rick Gerken is part of a team that's put together something called a principal odor map, which aims to do for scents what the color wheel has done for, well, color. Gerken is a professor in the School of Life Sciences at ASU. He's also head of neuroscience at a startup firm called Osmo, which is dedicated to giving computers a sense of smell. More on that in a moment. Gerken stopped by the studio recently to talk about his work, and we started with what the principal odor map actually is.
Yeah, the principal odor map, you can think of it as a color wheel for smell. So when you're very young, you learn the relationships between the colors. And you see this color wheel where on this wheel are colors that are seem like they look very similar to each other are located in nearby locations on the color wheel. And colors that are very different from each other are located in sort of opposite ends of the color wheel. And so the principal odor map is essentially that for smell. So we can take any molecule, and all smells are just caused by molecules going into the air and then going into your nose and being detected by your nervous system. And it takes any molecule and it projects it into this map. It puts it, it finds a location for it on the map that makes sense so that molecules that smell similar to each other are in similar places on the map, and molecules that smell very different from each other are in different places. And then you can look at the map and you can say, oh, that's where all the peach smells lie, and oh, that's where all the jasmine smells are, and so on.
Is there universal agreement about which smells are actually those of peach or jasmine or rose or grass or particular foods?
There can be differences between people and between different cultures, but generally speaking, people who are skilled in the art of smell, of master perfumers, for example, will tend to largely agree on that, no, this is a grassy molecule, this is a peach molecule, and so on.
What is the importance of being able to sort of visually see these molecules and sort of what smells like other things?
The visual part of it is sort of just eye candy in a sense. What really gives it power is that it's a digital representation of what a smell is. And because it's a digital representation, you can computers can use it, right? So you can use that in a number of ways. You can use that to predict, for example, what a new molecule will smell like that you might want to create, or what a mixture of such molecules might smell like if you were trying to formulate a new fragrance, for example. And then you can use that in you know, artificial intelligence applications to look a little bit further and see, you know, what else you can do with that technology, like, for example, scent teleportation.
All right. So let's talk about scent teleportation, which I know is something that you're looking to work on next. What exactly does that refer to?
Scent teleportation is the, you know, olfactory or smell analogy to taking a picture and sending it to your friend. So we take for granted that now, you know, no matter what I'm looking at, I can just take a little photo of it and I can send it to you and you can see what I see. And that's not something that we can do for smell. And it wasn't always something that we could do for vision either. In the 1800s, after camera technology or photographic technology was first developed, if you wanted a photograph, someone had to come to your property and they bring two wagons. And the wagons are basically mobile chemistry labs, one to take the picture and one to develop the picture.
Right.
And they required a lot of expertise. So it's very slow. And if you've seen, you know, old-timey photographs, they weren't that good. Over time, that technology became democratized by companies like Kodak that were able to take the same basic kind of technology and make it more portable, more accessible to more people, something that kind of worked almost every time. And then people could share pictures with each other. And it was this amazing thing that brought the visual world to everyone. And we want to do the same thing for smell.
So does that mean that I could be standing in a park somewhere and smell a particular flower, and somehow I could have somebody who is not with me smell that exact same flower?
That is the goal.
How do you do that?
So there are various kinds of sensor technologies. In the same way that in a camera, you have ways of capturing photons of light that are hitting the camera, and then that gets stored as a digital representation in either in the memory of the camera or in an older version of this where you had film, mm-hmm. it would impinge upon the film. It would make some sort of an imprint that you could then go use later to develop the film. So similarly, there are technologies to say these are the molecules that are in the air. Some of the molecules are important for the smell and some are not. So the most important thing is you'd be able to detect the ones that are important and then use that to make a digital representation of what the smell was at that time and place that you were smelling. And then once you have that representation, you want to recreate that on the other end. So once this information can be sent as bits, you know, over the internet like anything else, and then on the other end you have some sort of a device that takes that representation and turns it back into some molecules, maybe not the same molecules, maybe very different molecules, but that have the same odor profile, that smell the same as this flower you smelled in the park.
So what are the applications of this? Because I would imagine it would be really nice, like – I love the smell of my mom's apple pie, for example. She could send that to me if I'm not at her house. But I would imagine there also have to be more applications for it than just, you know, feeling good about family or like, you know, if you're somebody who really loves the smell of fresh cut grass or something. Like, are there more maybe societal applications for this?
Well, I wouldn't underrate just feeling good about things. That's mostly why we take photographs too. But you can document what is happening in place, not just visually or in terms of sound, but in terms of the smell, in terms of the chemical environment that's mm-hmm. there. So it could be something where you need to identify, I'm in this environment and what this smell is signaling something. It's signaling something about the state of food or some sort of scenario that could be dangerous, so some sort of chemical hazard or the presence or absence of a certain kind of animal, for example. Or a medical diagnostic, you know, many kinds of diseases create volatiles that are released by the human body, volatile molecules that are a signature of that disease. Animals can smell them. We know they can do it. If we could smell the same things with computers that were portable and we all had them in our pocket, then we could do, you know, early detection of a lot of very bad diseases.
So how long do you think it might take until scent teleportation becomes a reality?
And at the company Osmo that I work for, we have various milestones for scent teleportation, and we are hoping that within a year we'll have some real progress to show there.
Really?
Yeah. Now this is still a research problem, but we want to democratize smell. We want to put this in the hands of people. So releasing products, I mean, that's a much longer timeline. It took, you know, Kodak decades and decades to go from essentially being able to do photography that's accessible to people versus, you know, mass market production, right? Mm-hmm. And we'd like to speed run that as much as possible, but it will still take time.
Right. So do you think that while you're working on that, does having sort of a map of the molecules that create scents, does that help people maybe sort of start to think about what scents are and what they're actually made of and come up with, you know, some sort of language that they can use to describe them, you know, so that when this scent teleportation comes online at some point, that maybe people are more ready to be able to use it and use it in the way that you're hoping they do?
Yeah, I think it'd be very educational. So if you want – take a color wheel example. So you've probably seen a color wheel where there has little wedges and the wedges are already given names, right? Red, mm-hmm. orange, and yellow and so on. But there's a different kind of idea of a color wheel, which is called a CIE color space, which is what's used for color correction in production applications. There's no labels of colors on that map, but you can nonetheless see all the colors and you can see how they relate to – wavelengths of light and various combinations of wavelengths of light. But in by analogy in with smells, having developed this map, and the map itself doesn't say what the locations on the map, how they're labeled, right? It's like a big map of countries that just have the outlines but don't have the names, right?
Okay.
You and I can go and smell one part of the map, a bunch of things that all smell very similarly. We could say, okay, we're going to call that Muguet. Muguet is already a technical term, corresponds to Lily of the Valley. But if you use the map, you can actually like really like label things much more formally, and I could share that map with you and you could say, okay, when we're here, that means it's this word. And we're at this other location, that's this other word. And then we can learn how to communicate about odor.
Rick Erkin is a professor in ASU School of Life Sciences and head of neuroscience at the firm Osmo.
All right, that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.